This week on the Best of Flashpoints. In Gaza, 750,000 refugees may be plunged into darkness without food, fuel, or medical supplies. An interview with Cynthia McKinney on her presidential campaign and her response to Obama's election. The latest commentary from death row prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. A discussion of the global climate change emergency with an activist working with Latin American indigenous communities. And how will Obama shut down Guantanamo Bay Prison? Nora Barros-Friedman, J.R., Eric Klein, and Emily Howard are all coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barros-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. U.S.-made Israeli warplanes fired several missiles into the occupied Gaza Strip earlier today after an invasion by Israeli occupation forces with tanks and armored bulldozers. Four Palestinians were killed in the missile strikes, all of them resistance activists, and this deadly attack by Israeli forces against Palestinians in Gaza comes on the heels of last week's similar siege, in which six Palestinians were killed. Palestinian resistance factions have responded to the illegal and truce-breaking strikes by Israel with intermittent crude rocket fire. Meanwhile, the United Nations Relief Works Agency is reporting that the tightening Israeli blockade since last week's attack directly affects 750,000 Palestinians dependent on food and supplies. Christopher Guinness, the agency's spokesperson in Gaza, reported today that this is clear collective punishment by Israel against the Palestinian people in Gaza, and that, quote, something very unusual is happening here. This is becoming a blockade against the UN itself. Guinness added that the UN was attempting to get material and supplies into a school for blind children, but that Israel has prevented it. He said, quote, these blind children, as far as I'm aware, are not firing rockets. At the same time, outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert stated that another full-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip was, quote, just a matter of time. Joining us to talk about the current situation on the ground inside Gaza is Amjad Shawa. Shawa is the Gaza coordinator for the Palestinian NGO Network and speaks to us from Gaza City. Amjad Shawa, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Many thanks, Nora.
So first off, Amjad, talk about what happened today and what's the mood on the ground tonight in Gaza City?
Of course, the situation is not just unusual. It's a real catastrophe that Gaza is facing. As the honorable man mentioned, about 80% of the population in Gaza Strip are depending on the UNRWA and other international agencies and their food and their main live resources. It means that in a few other days that Gazans people will starve. They will be starving because of the shortage of medicine and food. All this happened in this kind of strange silence from the international community. Our children are paying the price of this silence. So the people outside Gaza Strip must understand that here in Gaza, we are paying from our future. Israel is violating the basic human rights on the Gaza. And this is the eighth day that Israel closed all the border crossings. Again and again, we are just calling for one basic word. We are calling for justice.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what it looks like when the United Nations says it only has enough food and supplies for the next 48 hours for 750,000 people? What are people going to do?
It's a big question, really. What we will do is, just to mention number, 26,000 children are suffering of malnutrition. This is in Gaza. Israel is intending to destroy everything in Gaza, about 4,000 factories stopped working about 1.5 years ago. Thousands of professional workers stopped working. So the call now is it's an urgent call in order to intervene to stop this kind of killing on the Palestinians in Gaza, collective punishment and collective killing in Gaza people.
Amjad, what does the minimal amount of fuel mean to the 1.5 million people in Gaza? And how will hospitals and clinics and schools and homes operate right now with this crisis?
The big issue now is to end its siege completely and to let entering the quantities of fuel to operate the Gaza Now it's also not secret that about 122 medical items, medicines, is absent in the Minister of Health storage. About 260 patients died suffering of the shortage of medicines and denial of access to outside. So this number will, of course, will increase if there will be no intervention to end the issue of suffering of the people.
Amjad Shawa, the Israeli military, of course, is saying that this latest attack today was in response to rocket fire coming from the Gaza Strip by Palestinian resistance forces. But last week, Israel broke the truce that was holding since June when it attacked the Gaza Strip and killed six people, as we mentioned. And days before that, Israeli warships stationed off the coast of Gaza opened fire on Palestinian fishermen. How do Palestinians manage during times like these? How do you keep going, Amjad? What keeps you going?
As Martin Luther King said, we have a dream. And we'll catch on our dream. And our children will keep it. And we have no trees to be under. So we are facing this kind of situation. And, as civilians, nothing to protect us. We are calling for our freedom, for our liberty. And hopefully one day that our children maybe will reach that we'll get the real independence to build our own state in Gaza, West Bank, and Jerusalem.
All right. Well, that's the voice of Amjad Shawa. He is the Gaza coordinator for the Palestinian NGO Network. Amjad, as always, thank you so much for all of your work, and please be safe.
Many thanks.
عصفور طل من الشباك وقال لي يا نونو خبيني عندك خبيني دخلك يا نونو خبيني عندك خبيني دخلك يا نونو قلت له انت من وين قال لي من حدود السماء قلت له جاي من وين قال لي من بيت الجيران قلت له خايف من مين قال لي من القفص هربان قلت له ريشاتك وين قال لي فرفطها الزمان عصفور طل من الشب وقال لي يا نونو خبيني عندك خبيني دخلك يا نونو ونزلت عخد ودمعة وجناحاته متكين وتهدى بالأرض وقال بدي امشي وما في ونزلت عخد ودمعة وجناحاته متكين وتهدى بالأرض وقال بدي امشي وما في وضميته عقلبي وصار يتوجع على جروحاته قبل ما يكسر الحبس تكسر صوته وجناحاته قلت
You are listening to POCC Block Report Radio with the Minister of Information, JR, on Flashpoints. Today we will be talking to Cynthia McKinney, the Green Party's presidential candidate, as well as former congresswoman, about her experience campaigning across the country. We will talk to her also about the similarities and differences between McCain, herself, and Obama, as well as her sentiments on the bailout and the election of Barack Obama as president of the United States. I started off by asking her to describe her experience campaigning all across the country.
It has been really, for me, a very interesting journey. I didn't know what to expect. I was open to every possible experience, and that's a good thing because I was able to travel to 28 states. And the interesting interesting thing is that we found that there is a small and highly informed and extremely committed community of people out there who understand what the limitations of the two-party system are. And for us, then, it was very important to make a connection with them. And so now that the election is over, we can look at the results and we can see that there's approximately 150,000 people across this country who heard our message and who believe in our message. We are now able to organize better and to mobilize and to strategize because these are our most serious and committed people.
I know that you had a number of things on your platform, but what did the people gravitate towards most? Barack Obama or McCain didn't address many of the issues that you addressed.
You know, we really enjoyed support from a cross-section of the community. So therefore, when we put out our platform, we had, for example, reparations, an end to the drug war, an end to the prison industrial complex, release of political prisoners, eliminating the private Federal Reserve and nationalizing the Federal Reserve. After the bailout became an issue, we went further into what it would take in order for the Democratic Congress to transform our banking industry and the U.S. economy with an emphasis toward full employment, jobs that would green our economy, war it no longer is an acceptable energy policy, revamping the banking industry, nationalizing it, in fact, so that the people's ownership is translated into a change in what credit means and how credit is used. Credit should be used to help small business owners and individuals and not something that is extended to just a few certain people and then ignored when those few certain people who seem to always get the political and then the economic advantage betray the public purse and the public's values. We also talked about eliminating U.S. imperialism. Of course, that meant ending all wars and occupations and then bringing all of our troops home from the more than 100 countries around the world in which they are stationed at U.S. bases. Now, it's interesting that when we talked about, for example, placing former Comptroller General David Walker in charge of auditing every dollar of the bailout that went to J.P. Morgan, Bear Stearns, AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, we were completely ignored. But guess what?
What?
Now, the Fed has refused to give an accounting for its expenditures that are backed by us, the public. And so if my advice had been heeded at that time and the Democrats in the Congress had put in place accountability, openness, transparency, we wouldn't have the situation now with the Fed refusing to disclose who got $2 trillion. I mean, this is absolutely outrageous. It is it's so across the top that it is unthinkable, but yet it's happening today. We put forward a forward agenda on energy, on social justice, on the environment, on employment, on health care, on education, an affirmative agenda that basically was ignored by the status quo powers that be, media and the special interest political parties. But we now know that there are people who did hear the message.
No doubt. How do you feel about the bailout?
Well, of course, now we understand that the members of Congress who came before the public and said, we've got to take care of Main Street. This is not just for Wall Street. They lied. Because the money, with no strings attached, no alternative was ever considered, Nancy Pelosi could have drawn up something that had the provisions in it that I described, like the standardized accounting procedures, the national moratorium on foreclosures, the elimination of derivatives trading could have been included in the legislation, but they weren't. And so now, as a result, we've seen banks acquire other banks, throwing huge parties for their executives with our money. And it's a travesty. But this is what the Democratic-controlled Congress wanted, and this is what they got.
I know that you faced criticism across the country because some people may have felt that you were splitting the vote from either women with the first women candidates as well as with the first black candidate, Barack Obama, running. How did you respond to that?
Well, basically, what I reminded folks of is that ultimately the voters have the choice. And they can vote for special interest political parties, or they can do as I did. I declared my independence from the national leadership that made our country complicit in war crimes, torture, crimes against humanity, and crimes against the peace. That same national leadership that had failed to provide a living wage for our workers, that had failed to provide a single-payer health care system, a Medicare for all type of system for all of us who live within the boundaries of this country, that had chosen to spend $720 million every day for war instead of subsidizing education so that no young people who want a college education should graduate from college tens of thousands of dollars in debt. These are the choices that were available to all of the voters. And I was under no circumstance going to compromise my values. I value peace and social justice, and I knew that we weren't going to get that as a working agenda from the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, because they basically said that. And so when the time came to protect civil liberties with the bill, the vote on the telecom immunity, both the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee voted to erode our civil liberties. I would never have done that. And when the time came to vote for the bailout, both of them again voted for the bailout. They support war and occupation by either in Iraq or even both of them support a surge in Afghanistan. So that's more war, more occupation. So those are not my values, and I would never have voted for them. And now the record reflects that there are about 150,000 people who heard our message, and that they also were determined that they were not going to vote for somebody else's values. They were going to vote for their own values.
No doubt. Can you break down what are the differences between the Democratic candidate, Barack Obama, who won, and Senator McCain, who happened to lose? What are the nuances? Because I know that they're very little, but can you lay it out? Like, what are the nuances, and also put them in comparison to what your agenda was pushing?
Well, basically, they both agreed on the fact that we were not going to have a single-payer health care system, we were not going to have a livable wage, we were not going to repeal the Patriot Act, the Secret Evidence Act, or the Military Commissions Act. We were not going to see an end to U.S. wars of imperialism. There was going to be a residual force in Iraq under a Barack Obama administration, and there would be a larger residual force in Iraq under a McCain administration, but there would be a residual force of our troops there nonetheless. And they both agreed in the surge in Afghanistan. So basically what we had were differences around the margins, not substantial differences that I believe the people of this country were voting for. And now that we have an electorate that is engaged and is interested in the rest of the story, I believe that we also have an enhanced, increased, attentive community that is ready to hear our values and our policy prescriptions, because at the end of the day, I believe what voters will understand is that the election really wasn't about a horse race or a fashion show or a beauty contest or a popularity contest. It's about whose values are going to get allocated in the national government. And for that, I think people will find increasingly that it's not their values that are being allocated.
Did you know Barack Obama while you were a member of Congress?
I did have the opportunity to be sworn in at the same time in January 2005 when Barack Obama was sworn into the United States Senate. And, of course, while I was protesting the Ohio electors because of the voter fraud, the election fraud that took place in the state of Ohio, Barack Obama sat quietly. While I was engaged with Condoleezza Rice as she was being considered for Secretary of State and would have loved to have had the opportunity in the House International Relations Committee to drill her on a variety of issues, including what happened to the national security brief that was on her desk pertaining to September 11th, when Senator Obama had the opportunity to do that same level of questioning, it just didn't happen. There were a series of softball questions that were asked that basically gave Condoleezza Rice the opportunity to do what she has done now on the international stage without any kind of pre-reckoning as to what those policies that she was going to put forward might have been and the impact that these policies were going to have, not only on those of us inside this country, but for the global community as well.
How did you feel when Barack Obama was selected to be president of the United States?
Well, of course, I think everyone was elated with respect to a barrier that had been broken. And I remember, you know, seeing the black and white footage of when Jackie Robinson broke a barrier in baseball. And then, of course, for a very long time, there was no such thing as a black quarterback in football. And now we have black quarterbacks all over the NFL. And, you know, breaking barriers is important. And a barrier has been broken now, because the racially polarized block voting, we have to do some analysis, particularly with respect to the Voting Rights Act states. And we need to analyze the extent to which racially polarized block voting was broken down. And at the same time, we need to understand that the tremendous media success that candidate Obama had, and of course the fundraising success, does not translate to average, ordinary, underfunded candidates who are voices of the community. And so therefore, certain parameters of the Voting Rights Act should not be adjusted to the detriment of those voting blocks that have traditionally been discriminated against and disfranchised.
How do you feel the election, say, went? Were there any errors? Were there any scandalous actions. Can you tell the people, because I know that you keep your eye very closely on that, as you did in 2004 and in previous elections, but can you speak to what went on this election?
Well, of course, there were massive electronic voting machine failures, but in addition to that, there's a problem in Iowa right now. But I think that under the circumstances, people are satisfied with the result, and so therefore there won't be any outcry as a result of the overwhelming turnout that we all experienced on November 4th.
You were just listening to the voice of Cynthia McKinney, the Green Party's presidential candidate, as she talked about her experience campaigning all across the country, her analysis of the bailout, as well as her analysis of what the two-party candidates were about, and her sentiments on the selection of Barack Obama as president of the United States. This concludes part one of the interview. Part two will be played tomorrow. This is the Minister of Information, J.R., for www.blockreportradio.com. We out.
And now we go to journalist and death row political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal for this commentary.
A day of days. I've expected an Obama win, and only the prospect of grand theft could have changed that expectation. That's because I'd read of the polls, listened to pollsters, and studied the political map. Plus, the coolness of Senator Barack Obama's campaign was in sharp contrast to the frenzied style and open infighting among supporters of Arizona Senator John McCain. There was also the nasty, derisive tone of many who supported McCain, as perhaps best encapsulated by the Republican convention, where a slew of presenters mocked Obama's past experience as a community organizer. It elicited guffaws and gales of laughter. Now we see that such skills, aided, of course, by the reach and ubiquity of the Internet, were perhaps more valuable than a law degree. I'd expected it, but no one could have predicted the enormous outpouring of emotion, both across the country and around the world. Within moments of the election results announcement, streets filled with people in Harlem, in Chicago, in Kenya, in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco, and beyond. Celebrations erupted in Europe and Asia, in Japan, in Australia, and almost all the celebrants were young people. In nearby Pittsburgh, college students and other young people just took to the streets, a spontaneous demonstration of joy. Unlike any election in generations, this race drew out enormous numbers of first-time voters and young folks between 18 and 30. Indeed, Obama carried all age groups up to those over 65. This was, in sheer historic terms, an impressive political event. Now the hard work begins. For of all the challenges facing the president-elect, the economy, upon which all else depends, is the most daunting. If the recent big bailout is any measure, there's far more bad financial news to come. Businesses and banks will fiend for more public monies, just as a dope fiend craves crack. In a sense, capital entered its vote the day after Election Day, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling some 500 points. The challenges facing the president-elect may ultimately prove insurmountable, yet they are his. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We used to have our liberties way back in the day, but it was for our own good that they took them away. Now it's Homeland Security following you around. Old George cut that cherry tree and I guess it finally hit the ground. Cause there's a new George now, and he's got an axe of his own, and he's grinding it real sharp, and he's cutting it to the bone. Filet of America, and he'll feed it to the dogs, all for a bunch of good old boys riding high on the hog. And goodbye America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner turning, gonna be a long corner turning back again. I'm getting used to surveillance and I'm getting used to the cops. I'm getting used to law and order when I don't know when to stop. I'm getting used to soldiers, I can see them in my sleep. I'm getting used to everything and that gives me the creeps. They say that once we were a beacon, we shone like a star. 200 years later, well, and here we are. Looking out at the world through bulletproof glass. Following a gunslinger, preppy with his head up his ass. Goodbye, America, I'll say I knew you when. It was a long corner turning, gonna be a long corner. Turning back again. We used to think we were so superior we could tell God what to do. We thought we'd last forever, yeah, and we acted like it too. Way up in this house of cards, just waiting for a breeze. And I think I hear the wind.
In Berkeley, I'm Eric Klein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. According to the ACLU, since January 11th, 2002, approximately 775 people have been held at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. The majority of those have been released over the years without trial. That leaves about 250 prisoners that are likely to still be held at Gitmo when President-elect Obama is sworn in next year. It appears as though Obama plans to swiftly close Gitmo down. Human rights experts are calling on him to try the remaining detainees in U.S. federal court or let them go. But according to an AP story today, some of Obama's advisors, speaking on condition of anonymity, say that they could set up a special court system just for, quote, highly sensitive national security cases. In other words, a terrorism court. Today on Flashpoints, we will hear from Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. What should President-elect Obama do with the Guantanamo Bay situation, both prisoners, the precedent, you know, the building, the people in it, and what it stands for, and what might we say he is going to do, if that's possible?
Well, he has said publicly, openly on his website, etc., that he's going to close Guantanamo, that he's going to give people real trials if they are ready for real trials, which is to say if they're deserving of real trials. If not, they'll be released. So that's what he has said. What he should do on the first day he takes office, he should announce that he's closing Guantanamo, and he should present a plan for doing so very quickly. The high majority of people, 200 out of the 255 left, maybe more, can be returned almost immediately to their home countries. Others might be tortured if they're returned to certain countries. Those people he has to find places that can take them, or bring them into the U.S. Those are people like the Uyghurs from Western China, not considered dangerous. They should be brought in. There's a few who the U.S. claims, if the U.S. claims more than probably I claim, that are may have been involved in terrorism, and those people ought to have real trials. This is just the bottom line. I think he has to do it not only because of the people we represent at the center, but also because of the worldwide reputation, stain on the reputation that Guantanamo and the torture program have really caused. So it's actually a real necessity. I actually think he'll do it as much as I begin to see writings now in the Times. In other words, oh, this isn't so easy. It's difficult. I mean, trying to set him up to change his mind. But I actually think this is one promise that he'll keep it for no other reason, that our world reputation depends on it. The second thing he ought to do, but this I don't expect, and I haven't seen any president say this, he ought to return Guantanamo to Cuba. I mean, we took it illegally in the late 1800s, forced Cuba to give it to us in a permanent lease, and he ought to do that. That I don't expect, although I think it's the right thing to do. The second area, clearly, that he ought to do is ban and stop torture. And they've done that more or less with regard to the military, but he has to do it with the CIA and other U.S. agencies. President Bush vetoed the bill that would have applied the prohibition on torture to the CIA, that would have prohibited the CIA from waterboarding. Obama voted in favor of that prohibition. Unfortunately, Bush vetoed it. And so I think one of the other things he could do on the first day he takes office is issue an executive order, much like he could issue for Guantanamo, issue an executive order banning any detainee in the custody of the United States, any agency from being tortured, abused, treated cruelly, violation of Geneva, etc. That's the second thing. The third thing he has to do is stop the practice of extraordinary rendition, which is sort of a combination of Guantanamo and torture. It's sending people to other countries where they could be tortured. That has to stop. Again, he can do that by executive order. And lastly, he has to have real trials for people, not just these military rump kangaroo trials, but either courts martials or federal trials. So those are four things he can do quickly. Those are four things he's essentially promised the American people. And I think I'm hopeful he'll do it, but of course it's important that we all push him to do so.
So because the Center for Constitutional Rights represents detainees, and if the evidence that the United States has was obtained under torture, or even if it wasn't, if the people were tortured at all, how is it possible to just take a step backwards from the Bush administration's lawless policy to bring these detainees into the law if they've been outside of the law for up to 7 years?
They have a serious problem. I mean, a really serious problem, which is to say that most of their evidence is most likely from torture. And because of that, they're going to have trouble with any kind of trials. But the answer is not to try them as they are now and let in evidence of coercion and torture. The answer is to bring them into federal trials. And if they can develop independent evidence from torture, then they can try those people with that evidence or find other independent evidence. I mean, the U.S. has very dirty hands in this, obviously. And the only question is, should the U.S. be able to benefit from those dirty hands? I mean, we have that rule here all the time that if the cop smashes into your house to take evidence, he can't use the evidence against you, and you don't go to jail because of that. Now, I don't know what evidence they have, and they've never had a hearing where they've had to present it in a really serious way. So we'll see. If they have someone who's really involved in terrorism, then I would hope they have genuine evidence to be able to hold them. But if not, boy, this government deserves really very, very serious, heavy blame for really doing what we all told them they would be doing wrong, which is when you torture people, one, you get false information, for starters, but secondly, to the extent you get anything, you can't use the evidence. They knew it, and they went ahead anyway.
So then, I'm not a legal expert at all, but I can imagine the scenario where the Guantanamo detainees come into the federal court system, but then their trial, which may or may not be very serious, would just become a trial against Guantanamo and the Bush years, as opposed to the individuals and their alleged crime.
Well, certainly part of the trial will be how these defendants were treated, how they were coerced, how basically nothing that was said about them, certainly by other people who were coerced and tortured, is going to be reliable. They're going to need some hard physical evidence to get these guys. If there's really bad people among them. The problem here is that of the 900 or so people who floated through Guantanamo, and floated is the wrong word, but have gone through what I consider the torture chambers of Guantanamo, almost 600 have been freed already. 255 remain, and of that, the high majority shouldn't be there at all and should be freed. So we're talking about a very small number of people who the U.S. claims, even the U.S. claims, should be tried. I mean, and we're not talking about the people they've been. Look at their first trials. They tried Bin Laden's chauffeur. Then they tried a media person. I mean, when are they going to start trying the guys who they claim were involved in 9/11? So there's a handful of those people, and my guess is they should, if they, these guys have given, even some of them, even before they got to Guantanamo, gave press conferences and other things, or at least videos of their involvement. So there's probably some independent evidence against a few of them, but I don't know.
And then finally, this is maybe the silly one with the crystal ball, but what kind of people? I mean, everyone's playing the game with what Barack Obama's cabinet is going to look like now, and it's coming together over the next many weeks. And what kind of people would be for you a good sign that the President Obama would be moving in the direction that you'd like to see? And what kind of people might be a bad sign?
Well, I mean, it depends on what area we're talking about. Certainly the chief of staff that he's chosen, Rahm Emanuel, is not exactly on the progressive side of the agenda. I mean, he was a Clintonista. He was someone who at least on a number of issues, was not exactly progressive, part of the Democratic Leadership Council. And so I don't consider the fact that Obama is starting to surround himself with people from the Clinton administration is exactly wonderful. And I, of course, worry most about, in our area, who's going to head the military, for one, whether he retains Gates or whether he puts someone else in, who's going to head the, who's going to be the Attorney General. And you know, on that, I would like to see someone who's going to say, let's put us back on the page of law, let's do a thorough inquiry as to what crimes were committed, and let's go forward. I can describe the characteristics much more than I can the person. I mean, there's obviously people out there from Harold Coe at Yale Law School, the dean, people like that who would be, you know, who'd be excellent for these kind of jobs. Whether or not they have a good chance of getting the job, I don't know.
Who in the cabinet would be responsible for closing Gitmo? Just to say it that way.
Well, it would be. I mean, Gitmo is run by the U.S. military, so technically it would be under the Pentagon. But so it would be Gates technically who would have to close it. That's who's interrogating people. That's whose order they're held under. The initial order to hold people at Guantanamo was what I called November 13th, 2001, what the president called the military order number one. And it was the president who designated people to be picked up and detained by the U.S. military, by the Department of Defense. And so technically when you sue to get someone out of Guantanamo, you sue their custodian, and one of the custodians, or the main one, is the military.
And so many people have said interesting, less stridently supportive things of Guantanamo in the past handful of years. Has Secretary Gates said anything that is encouraging?
Well, they've all said. I mean, even Bush said, and Gates said, "I want to close Guantanamo," but they all said, "We can't do it yet." I mean, Gates has said that. He came into office saying that. The State Department is more interested in closing Guantanamo. They don't have the authority to do it, but they are certainly more interested because they understand how it's completely ruining U.S. reputation around the world. So, you know, I it's going to take really, I mean, to close Guantanamo is going to take the political will of one single person, and that's the President of the United States, that's Obama. Because without that, the underlings just aren't going to do it, and not going to have the authority. It's an important decision. It's a big decision. It's one that I think Obama has made already. At least he said he has made it. And I just want to see what happens.
How can we sit here intellectualizing when we know what's happening is wrong? Causing mass extinction while doctors use machines on human lives to prolong. If someone's playing deciding who should be alive and who should not. If someone plays with fire, but you know he's only building his own funeral pyre. And in my mind I cannot see global suicide for the few who live in luxury. Perhaps it's up to you and I to save this world. We'll have to put up one hell of a good fight. A good fight. And we have a voice and bodies that are strong as the mountain. Yes, we have a choice. Part of the destruction, or do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth. Do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth. Do what you can, do what you must, but just do something to defend the earth. Defend the earth.
In Berkeley, I'm Emily Howard. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. For the past week here at Flashpoints, we've been covering world reaction to the election of Barack Obama. We'll continue that coverage in part with our next guest. Ann Petterman is one of the co-directors of the Global Justice Ecology Project based in Vermont. The organization works on issues of climate change, indigenous rights, and water privatization. She's spoken up for economic justice at the United Nations, and she joins us here in the Flashpoint studio today. Ann Petterman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So I'd like to start out by talking about the Kyoto Protocol, the protocol which has been all but laughed at by the Bush administration, who seemingly placed the gains of industrial capitalism above the need for a clean and sustainable future. Now, you've talked about corporate-controlled, quote-unquote, false solutions to climate change. We're talking clean coal and clean energy. And now Barack Obama says he supports all these initiatives. But where are we with the advocating at the highest levels for addressing root causes for climate change?
Well, when it comes to the United Nations has not been real great yet at actually getting to the root causes of climate change, which is one of the things that when we go to these UN climate conventions, we're really pushing for them to stop looking toward the market, stop looking toward corporations to provide so-called solutions that are more in the form of unsustainable biofuels or clean coal or nuclear, things that are all about corporate profit, but not really about getting to the core problem of what's causing climate change. And so we've been going to these UN meetings and joining together with our allies from all over the world, from other organizations, indigenous peoples organizations, people representing communities that are actually being impacted right now already by climate change, as well as those who will be impacted in the future. So actually, when you talk about the Kyoto Protocol, that's actually not something that we're real happy about either, although from the exact opposite perspective, the Kyoto Protocol was extremely weak. It only called for 5.2% reductions in carbon emissions below 1990 levels by the year 2012, and it included so many different market-based approaches that it actually hasn't even done that. It called for very limited and not really scientifically effective reductions in carbon emissions, and it couldn't even meet those. So carbon emissions have continued to increase, even though the Kyoto Protocol was ratified in 2005. It has contributed to all kinds of destruction in the global south in these false solution carbon projects, these carbon offset projects that are, for example, putting in monoculture tree plantations, huge tree plantations, industrial tree plantations onto indigenous lands, kicking indigenous communities off their lands for these tree plantations, specifically so they can say that they're storing carbon so that companies in the north can continue to put out their pollution. So anyway, there's a lot of problems with the Kyoto Protocol. So what we're saying is it's almost 2012. It's time for the post-Kyoto framework. That is, when the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012, we're going to be seeing a new international framework on climate change. And that has got to have real strong reductions in carbon emissions, no more false solutions, no more carbon trading and carbon offsets and all of these things that basically mean that companies can continue to pollute and still say that they're green. We need indigenous rights. We need climate justice. And that is what the international movement around the world is coming together to say, is any framework on climate change has got to be real and it has to include climate justice.
Now, continue to talk about the responsibilities for corporations and governments and their role in climate change. I mean, you started to talk about it a little bit in these what you called false solutions, but continue on with that line.
Well, the false solutions, specifically the ones that we and our allies are looking at, include, for example, one of the biggest is agrofuels, or what most people have heard of as biofuels. Agrofuels are specifically the large-scale, unsustainable biofuels, unsustainably produced biofuels, such as the corn from the Midwest that has led to all of these food riots around the world, the massive production of soy in South America that is destroying the Amazon rainforest and other forests in South America. Much of that soy is being used to produce biodiesel. It includes the huge destruction of the Indonesian peat forests, these ancient forests, ancient rainforests in Indonesia, for oil palm plantations, again, for biodiesel. which incidentally, the burning and destruction of those peat forests in Indonesia has made Indonesia the third largest emitter of carbon on the planet. So not only are agrofuels not a solution to climate change, in most cases, they're actually worsening climate change. And that's in addition to kicking indigenous peoples off their land, destroying forests, destroying biodiversity, and so on. So that is one of the key false solutions that is being heavily promoted by corporations that is, in fact, not a solution at all and is, in fact, making things worse. So those are the kinds of false solutions that we're addressing. Clean coal is another one, so-called clean coal, that wonderful oxymoron. There is no such thing as clean coal. Coal can't be clean. The mining of coal is incredibly destructive. The burning of coal is obviously destructive,
and so on. And the mountaintop removal
that
we've heard a lot about lately.
Which is incredibly destructive, looking down from the air on these mountains that have literally had their tops blown off to get the coal, and all of that rock is then dumped into the creeks on either side and, you know, destroys whole watersheds. It's unbelievably destructive. Anyway, so yeah, clean coal is ridiculous. Nuclear power is another one. So-called clean, you know, green nukes, I think is what Joe Biden called them. And again, you know, the uranium mining, the enrichment process, the shipping of the fuel rods, the dealing with the spent fuel rods and all of the nuclear waste that comes out of these plants, they are not a sustainable energy alternative. And they're very destructive also to the climate. They put out a lot of carbon emissions between the mining and the transportation and so on. So what we're saying is let's get beyond all of these giant corporate-controlled false solutions and find out what the real solutions are, the real community-controlled, small-scale, bioregionally appropriate solutions to climate change. There are thousands of them out there. We need those to be supported. Those are the things that we need to be focusing on and eliminate these corporate-controlled false solutions that are all about profit and not about the climate.
Ann Petterman, I don't know if it's beating a dead horse, but I am curious if you have some ideas on the responsibility of corporations who talk about these false solutions, if you see that there is some further steps they could take, in your view, to be held more responsible, more accountable for the pollution and destruction that they're creating.
Well, as far as holding corporations accountable, it would be nice if that was a component of the new Barack Obama administration. I wouldn't say that I'm holding my breath based on where he got a lot of his campaign financing. So I believe that this is holding corporations accountable is something that has to come from the grassroots. And that's one of the things that is beginning to happen all around the world and right here in the United States is this developing of this very powerful grassroots climate movement to hold corporations accountable, to hold the governments accountable, to say that we need real solutions to climate change and we the people are here to say this has to happen and it has to happen now. And so this is something that we're very excited about. There's a huge mobilization that is beginning to be planned around next year's, the 2009 UN Climate Convention, which is happening in Copenhagen. And interestingly, especially for folks here on the West Coast, the first day of the Copenhagen Climate Talks happens to also be the 10th anniversary of the WTO shutdown in Seattle, November 30th, 2009. And so that is a day that people are beginning to mobilize around to say, to put forth these demands for real action on climate change, for climate justice, and to say that we really need to take this seriously and do something about it that does not involve, you know, increasing corporate profits.
That's the voice of Ann Petterman joining us today here on Flashpoints. My name is Emily Howard. So, Ann Petterman, talk about the Mapuche indigenous tribes of Chile and Argentina. You've worked with indigenous tribes a little bit and their concerns to the United Nations.
Well, we've worked with the Mapuche specifically on the issue of industrial tree plantations and also genetically engineered trees. And where that intersects with the climate issue is that genetically engineered trees and industrial tree plantations are being proposed as some of these false solutions to climate change, both for large plantations that supposedly offset carbon emissions that I mentioned earlier to allow companies in the north to continue to pollute, but also for second generation or so-called cellulosic agrofuels. So in other words, biofuels, they're moving away from using food crops to make biofuels because of the massive impact it's had on food prices and starvation levels and so on. They're now saying, well, we can do this by using wood. We can basically use trees to make non-food-based agrofuels or biofuels. And what we're seeing in places like Chile, where the Mapuche live, is that their lands, their agricultural lands, are being targeted for increasing tree plantations. So in other words, the government is providing these economic incentives to basically force people to turn their land from agriculture into tree plantations, which means that the amount of food available in these communities is diminishing. Over a third of the population in those areas lives in poverty. The tree plantations there have had incredibly detrimental impacts. They dump herbicides and fertilizers on these plantations, which get into the water, which cause disease in the communities nearby. The water is depleted. In some places that used to have year-round supplies of water, they now have to truck water in during the spring because the tree plantations take up so much water. And in addition, many times, if it's not agricultural lands that are being taken over for these tree plantations, it's native forest. So native forest is being destroyed to put in tree plantations, which, of course, is putting out all kinds of carbon emissions. 20% of carbon emissions every year come from deforestation. And tree plantations don't store as much carbon as forests. So when you cut down a forest and you replace it with a monoculture, single species tree plantation, all of a sudden you've decreased the amount of carbon that can be stored by that piece of land. So again, it's a very negative impact on the climate. It means that agrofuel feedstocks such as trees, even if they're not food, they continue to compete with food because they're taking over agricultural lands because it's more profitable to grow trees than it is to grow food. And it's bad for the climate. So it's bad for people. It's bad for the climate. So, again, there's many indigenous communities around the planet that have risen up and said, we need to stop these false solutions. They are impacting us. They are impacting our future. They are impacting our land. And this has to stop.
And finally, can you assess the growing worldwide movement for what we call coordinated direct action against climate change? What challenges do we face and what needs to happen now?
Well, clearly the greatest challenge is just that we're all over the planet and that, you know, creates some really big logistical problems. But we've been very heartened to see that people seem to be ready and anxious to take on those challenges head on. There was a meeting in Copenhagen where the climate talks are going to be next year, and a call to action on climate change came out of that meeting. It's already been translated into 20 different languages, so it's being disseminated all over the world. People are coming together in their own communities to talk about how to plug in, not just locally with climate action, but plug into this international effort so there can be coordinated actions around next year's climate convention. It's a very exciting, emerging movement that's happening, and we are very happy to be involved with it.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music breaks Jim Page, Long Corner Turning, and Alice DeMaselli, Defend the Earth. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.